Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The world works in certain ways until a new great idea comes along and changes everything.
We need a name.
We live.
We dream.
We work.
I'm Travis Kalanick, and I will never back down from a fight. And if no one wants to believe in me, I'll make them believe by being undeniable.
These kids don't overthink. They don't get bogged down about the way things have always been done. They want to change things now.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching Downfall of the Startups. I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson. I'm here today with Vanity Fair staff writer Chris Murphy. Chris, hello.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
glad you're here. So today we're covering three episodes. Super Pumped Episode 5, The Charm Offensive. The Dropout Episode 7, Heroes. And We Crashed Episode 5, Hustle Harder. Later on in the episode, we'll hear my interview with We Crashed creators Drew Crivello and Lee Eisenberg, who will talk about the moral questions of the show and some particular plot beats of Episode 5. As ever, if you have any questions, comments, corrections, whatever, as you listen along, please email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. So to start off, Chris, I want to ask you, as someone with an acting background, for a little performance review of all the many actors scattered across these three shows, who is working for you best?
Oh, wow. That is an incredible, incredible question. And yes, I did get a theater minor in college, which has been
My major beats you then.
Yeah, so maybe you should be answering this question. I have to say that I'm really impressed by both Anne Hathaway and Amanda Seyfried. Mother, daughter, and Les Mis are both doing amazing work. And I think they could very well be sort of facing each other when the Emmys roll around and sort of lead actress in a miniseries category. I really do think they're finding ways to humanize these sort of, given the way the stories have sort of transpired, maybe unlikable women or women who do things or who are a part of things that we've discovered are, you know, maybe not as savory as they were purported to be. So I would have to, give it to the ladies. I'd have to give it to Amanda Seyfried. I'd have to give it to Anne Hathaway.
See, this is why we have you on. I had not made that Les Mis connection until just now, until you made it for me.
Cosette and Fantine. Yeah. Minors are good for something.
There you go. Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with you on Hathaway, and I think that this episode of We Crashed is obviously a really big Rebecca episode. You know, something you'll hear in the interview with Crivello and Eisenberg about how they kind of did that characterization is that they don't, They recognize that when, you know, kind of building the show, having listened to the podcast, that like Rebecca is as equal a lead as Adam is. And I think that this episode really bears out kind of why that thinking is, because we see Rebecca moving or you know, really pushing her way more to the center of the company that she feels left out of. Yeah. I think that obviously that the core tension of the episode, it's actually most things in life do revolves around a Vanity Fair photo shoot. I think we can both agree.
I'm so happy to be here for the Vanity Fair episode. I'm like,
I know it's a very media heavy kind of run of all three of these episodes, actually.
Kismet. Yeah.
Yeah. So what did you make of how this episode of We Crashed kind of tracks Rebecca's psychology from, you know, finding her office is being used, the implication being she's never there, all the way to basically forcing Alicia out of the company. Did that all kind of track for you?
Yeah, and it was actually pretty tragic. It was like sort of like a mini movie amongst all of the chaos of WeWork that I think was the most compelling. Like you said in last week's podcast with Hillary, I think it, for all of Rebecca's faults, it was really her friendship with Alicia was really sweet. It was actually really kind of lovely to see her have something that was her own and her own friend and her own identity apart from WeWork, apart from Adam, and to see her completely blow that up because of her own issues with her own ego and her own worth was tough. It actually, you know, emotionally affected me. And I thought, and Anna America Ferrer, who we have to say is a national treasure, she is so lovely on the show. I'm like sad that we might not see more of her now. I do think they really sort of show, even in the space of two episodes, like the rise and fall of their relationship, and Rebecca just completely destroying it because of her own ego, was affecting to me.
Yeah, America Ferrera is great. I hope that she comes, that Alicia comes back for one like big kiss off scene. I mean, she kind of already got it in this episode. Yeah. The so line good. Of like, you worry he outshines you because you don't have any shine of your own or whatever. I mean, that is the perfectly most devastating thing you could say to Rebecca Newman.
Oh, 100%. It was 100% the most devastating thing. I also will say, I got to give it up for Anne. I've never seen somebody cry into napkins like to like not get their mascara in that way, to not ruin their mascara before a Vanity Fair shoot. And so all of that, that 1-2 punch, it really hit home for me because to be in so many shadows at once, you've got Adam's shadow, you've got WeWork's shadow, you've got Gwyneth Paltrow's shadow, has to be difficult. And I do have empathy for that.
Yeah, I think that's what's so shrewd about the way that the show's written and the way that Hathaway performs it, is that even though you see Rebecca really, you know, vaingloriously just bulldozing her way through people, I still feel bad for her. Like, I still have a degree of empathy for her, which is a tricky thing to do, especially when you see her earlier in the episode literally fire a person from his livelihood because of, you know, quote, bad energy.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I have a question for you. Knowing how we sort of like treated Anne Hathaway as a society 10 years ago in the Les Mis era, it's hard not to sort of like track like that sort of the sympathy and the empathy that I now have for Anne Hathaway, given how terrible we all were to her, onto Rebecca. I feel like the casting there just is already that gives Rebecca an emotional core that I'm like, oh, like it, I'm already feeling somewhat empathetic to her.
Yeah, no, I think there is a real life parallel there, you know. I think that, you know, we saw way back in the early, I think it was the first or second episode of this show, you know, where Rebecca is still kind of pursuing her acting dreams. Like, only a from childhood theater kid like Anne Hathaway could get exactly that desperation, right? You know?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And it was that accent work was chef's kiss.
Yeah. But we know, then we do see that sort of, that there's sort of a sweetness to that sort of just unbridled ambition that now has very much curdled by this point in the WeWork story. And, you know, Rebecca Newman is still, I think, on the scene to some extent, and they obviously walked away from WeCrash with a lot of money. But I think this, at least in the contained world of this show, the contained story of this show, this is the beginning of her downfall, because now you can't keep firing people for bad energy and not have people turn against you. She kind of already had righted that ship earlier when they were at summer camp, and she said the thing about, oh, it's a woman's job to support men. She kind of got out of that okay.
Yeah.
But I think there's no return from this.
Oh, absolutely. And for firing people for, you know, eating food, you know, putting food on your like pig statue in your office, that was like, I was like, oh, she's really lost the plot. And she's sort of hungry. She's hungry for, and it's not even power, but for a space of her own. And I can, and the literal, I think it was so well done with like the literal people entering her space and taking over her space and her feeling so small. I think Alicia says this, you're small. It's just really, really well done and really articulated. I keep with actually this show and The Dropout, which we'll get to. It's like I keep coming back to this Macbeth, Lady Macbeth narrative, and the genders are switched in each show, which is so interesting to me. And in We Crashed, Rebecca is Lady Macbeth, but she's not even good at it, really, is the problem. And I think that's sort of, that's where we get this, you know, firing all these people. I want to be in Vanity Fair. I don't want to be a muse. I want to be a game changer. I want to be a maverick. I want to be a magician. I want to make some change.
Yeah. And it's interesting how she and Adam interact with one another in this episode. A lot of it's over the phone. Because he's busy traveling to Tokyo and around the world, signing new leases and dealing with, you know, his biggest new investor. And she becomes, in a way, one of the chorus of nattering voices who's just kind of bothering him. Obviously, she's his wife, and so he has to pay more special attention to her when, you know, with the Time 100 thing, but then that goes south. And then we get to this point where she's like kind of micromanaging the company. You know, I think there's nothing wrong with sort of making that, you know, let's go vegan initiative, but the way that he treats it, is just like, okay, fine. Just please stop complaining. He's not really hearing her.
Yeah. And it feels like, honestly, he had bigger issues at that point, which are only gonna sort of, spiral more out of control. But exactly, she was nagging. She literally became the embodiment of like the nagging wife, sort of like in his ear. Meh, meh, meh. And he gave her, you know, he did the vegan thing to sort of shut her up effectively. And it feels like he gave her the chief branding job for the exact same reason. I think the show did a really good job of sort of showing that, like, it wasn't because she, you know, had earned it or she was, you know, so vital to the soul of the company. But it was like, okay, like, she's annoying me. This is a really good way to keep her happy. And I think we see in further episodes later on, no spoilers, he continues to give her things to sort of sate her and to be like, you play with your toys in the corner while I do my big boy job and sort of keep this whole thing afloat, even though the ship is sinking.
And I mean, do you think in the way that this show is mapping the psychology of these characters, do you think Rebecca kind of knows that?
Oh, 100%. And I think that's why Anne Hathaway's performance is so fantastic, along with the voice, along with, I feel like she has somehow made her face longer. It's my boyfriend and I, when we're watching it, we're like, how is Anne Hathaway's face longer than it's ever been before? It's perfect for the character. But to answer your question, I do think she's like acutely aware of this fact, which is why she's constantly saying, you know, what's their line about, we were elevating the consciousness of the world. She has to hold on to these little mantras to sort of keep the actual sounds of in her head of, I'm actually not vital to this operation. I'm actually not, you know, important to the soul of the company. And my husband is treating me like I'm a nag and like I'm a child. And like, I, you know, I don't have any space here. I think that's the beauty of Anne's performance for sure.
Yeah. I like when she, you know, earlier in the episode, Alicia, it kind of rolls her eyes at raising the consciousness of the, or elevating the consciousness of the world. And then later on, when she's essentially firing her, she's like, a chief branding officer for this company should know that their mission, you know, she's like, I know you just made fun of it, but I actually believe this. Or maybe kind of she is telling herself she believes it.
And I mean, honestly, Alicia's right. It means nothing. But the thing is, I do believe that Rebecca believes it to be true. Like, I do believe that she thinks that that's her purpose and that she is elevating the soul of the nation, of the country, of the WeWork, whatever that, you know, her line is. But even more so than her believing in sort of the woo-woo stuff, she knows that she's not a factor. She is a muse. She is a plaything. She is the mother. She's the wife. But she's not the star. She's not, and she wants to be the star. And that's where Vanity Fair comes in.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where the theater kid comes in. You know, it's all, it really, everything can be sourced back to whenever the first time we all saw Our Town or whatever it was.
You know? Absolutely. It absolutely always comes back. It always comes back to that.
Maybe Rent. I don't know. Well, now that we've talked about Anne Hathaway and Rebecca Newman and all that, let's cut to my interview with Drew Crivello and Lee Eisenberg, who had more to say about that character specifically, this episode, and the show as a whole.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, I have the pleasure now of being on the line with the creators of We Crashed, Drew Crivello and Lee Eisenberg. Hello to you both.
Hello to you.
Hi there.
So, if you guys aren't aware, on this podcast, we're covering We Crashed, The Dropout, and Super Pumped, which are all different approaches to these kind of, I guess you could call them downfalls of entrepreneurs or, you know, unicorns, as your opening credits suggest. And something I really, really love about your show is that it's about a business, but it's really a human story, but with these two people at the center. And I'm curious, if either of you have an answer for this, like, what was the origin of that specific approach to this material? Because you could go really granular and focus on the business side, which the show does, but there's all this other emotional component. So I'm just curious about how you guys made that determination.
Drew, do you want to start?
Sure. So, you know, it began with the podcast. Wondery had sent Lee the podcast, and then and he flipped for it, and then he shared it with me. And really, it was sort of like we were kind of peeling back layers of this onion where, as we did more research and as we kind of learned more about WeWork beyond what we had just seen in the headlines, we just sort of found these two fascinating people at the sort of center of it all, right? And every time we started delving into the more granular business story, it always felt less interesting than the dynamics as we sort of imagined them between Adam and Rebecca. So there was just, you know, in Adam's own kind of origin myth or foundation myth of this company, he talks about how if not for Rebecca, WeWork would never have happened. And we wholeheartedly agree. So like, there's just this like center of gravity to that love story that kept pulling us back.
And you know, the one thing I would add to it is that it felt, the more that we dug into it, it wasn't like, it didn't feel like a choice that we were making narratively as storytellers. It felt that the only way to tell the story of WeWork, to tell the story of WeWork and really focus on Adam and then have Rebecca as someone that he comes home to after work would be dishonest. Rebecca's so intrinsic to the creation of the company and was there at every kind of key moment. And I think in many ways infused WeWork with this kind of yoga babble that, you know, became so much of the language and the ethos of the company that not having her in it and not having that love story at the center of it just didn't, it felt like we would be mistelling the story.
Something that's so beguiling about the early episodes is, you know, I went in having read a lot about the Newmans and including in Vanity Fair, and I expected to kind of hate them at the outset, but there are these moments with Adam and Rebecca where they're so deeply sympathetic. I mean, I think Rebecca's sympathetic. Adam is sort of perversely charming. You know, how did you guys balance that sort of empathy that I think this show has in abundance with the more critical aspects of who these people are and what they did?
Well, I guess from the outset, Lee and I, and then Jared and Annie, when they kind of came aboard, we had no interest in doing kind of caricatures, right? Or kind of just like an easy kind of finger wagging morality tale. So we kind of really wanted to get to the human beings at the center of this story. That was just more dramatically interesting to us. So I guess that was really, you know, as a way to avoid caricature, that's just what led us to just trying to figure out and learn who they were. And as we kind of explored their real life backstories, you can't help but to develop empathy for people when you sort of learn a little bit more about them. So I think it was that. It was the process of writing involved the process of kind of learning who they were and therefore developing empathy. I think we also tried our best
to show through the employees what the consequences of their actions were. So it was both not reducing them to caricatures, but at the same time, kind of balancing that with some accountability of, okay, well, they actually, people did suffer because of this.
Lee, I'm curious, do you think that how much of this utopian vision did Adam actually believe in? Was it a whole 100% of him really thought that he was going to change the world, or was that the marketing pitch?
You know, that it's funny you asked that, because that was something that Drew and I talked about from the outset, and was kind of posing that question. And it's been interesting now that people have finally been able to see the show. You know, people say to us, you know, oh, was it, clearly he was a con man. And, you know, I feel like a lot of people feel like that's the narrative, and Drew and I have our own takeaways from it. But, you know, what was interesting to us is having a show that lives in the gray, and is he a visionary or is he a cynic? And is he kind of weaponizing, you know, this kind of the yoga babble and millennial optimism, you know, in order to make a buck? Or was he someone who really did want to change the world? And that's something that's open for debate. And, you know, that it was something that was interesting to us as storytellers to kind of lay things out and then have the audience draw their own conclusions and debate about it.
There's that scene, I think it's in episode 2, where Adam is at, is it JP Morgan? Morgan Stanley?
Oh, yeah.
One of the big banks. And he's doing a sort of fireside chat for the employees. And he goes on this monologue that I think is really, at least in my interpretation, what the sort of inquiry at the heart of this show is, which is like, what was this ethos around the late, you know, aughts into the 2010s of like overhauling life, maybe starting with aesthetic, but then kind of broadening it out. I mean, you know, Instagram culture. I mean, a culture really has an aesthetic culture sprung up, you know, on social media, and then it kind of bled into the real world. WeWork is a big product of that, I think. Did in making this show, did it help you clarify the decade plus that we've just lived through? You know, because it's helping me sort of understand what culture in America just experienced.
You know, one of our writers said something that really stuck with us in the early days of the writer's room. She said, in many ways, like this time period and WeWork specifically, like it felt like the death of the millennial dream. And that was like such a kind of striking way to describe it. And I think for her, and she, as a millennial, like she felt very much this graduating from college, there was this notion that you could, you know, as Adam says, like change the world and kind of, you know, make a lot of money doing it. And that maybe that's not always true, you know? And I think there was this kind of, you know, this idealism that was sort of paired with kind of greed and other things. And I think sometimes was preyed upon by some of the people that were sort of recruiting millennials. So anyway, that was, we kind of routinely refer to this as a sort of the end of the millennial dream, this kind of time period.
It does feel a little apocalyptic in that way, you know, because it achieves this zenith of co-working and, you know, parties after at the end of the day and all the neon signs, and it feels so familiar and yet suddenly distant. Maybe COVID helped that. I don't know, but it's a really striking tone. And then you also zero in from the grander summation into these personal lives. And I'm curious, Lee, like how much, I mean, obviously there's a ton of source material about these two people, written, podcast form, all kinds of things. But some of this had to have been invented. I mean, I don't know, you know, did Rebecca really ghost into a crazy accent during a Chekhov production? I'm not sure. So can you talk a little bit about how you balanced the fact and the fiction you kind of necessarily had to create to fill things out?
Sure. You know, Jared Leto, I'm gonna steal from him for a moment. He has said, you know, this is a painting. This is a painting, not a photograph. And I think that's a good way of putting it. You know, Drew and I read everything that, you know, could possibly exist on Adam and Rebecca. We've listened to every interview. We've read 2 books, podcasts, you know, every YouTube video that they have where, you know, they're talking. We spoke to friends of theirs. We spoke to former employees. We spoke to investors. You know, we did our research on this. And, you know, to pull off something like this, a dramatic portrayal, you can never know what was actually said with Adam and Rebecca in their bedroom. And, that's okay. You know, that's part of our job as storytellers is to fill in those gaps. And there are plenty of things that we heard rumblings of that we didn't include that I think were, you know, could have been salacious or could have painted them in a different light. And ultimately, we that wasn't the story that we wanted to tell. And, you know, and we weren't looking, this wasn't meant to be a hit piece. We wanted to create three-dimensional characters where you're rooting for them at times, you're frustrated with them at times. And that was the key. And, you know, within that, you have to, you're taking all the information that's given to you, and then you try to build characters from that. And you want those characters to be dimensionalized. And yeah, there's definitely some creation that goes on with it. But again, we felt like we had spoken to enough people that we were really, we felt like we had a good sense of who Adam and Rebecca are. And now that the show has come out, we've spoken to people that know them personally and do feel like it was a fair portrayal. And that's what we hoped. Like I said, it wasn't, we never set out to say, oh, we're going to destroy these people. And nor did we say, we want to kind of put them on a, you know, put them on a pedestal and laud them.
And the one thing I would add to that, Richard, if I may, is that,
yeah,
like even with that scene you mentioned where she kind of puts on the Russian accent, you know, that scene gets a laugh, right? And, but that, in our opinion, the more important scene is actually the one that comes afterward where she breaks down in the staircase. Mm-hmm. So even that is sort of an example of like, it's not just the caricature or the kind of, you know, the easy shots. It's how are we trying to portray the sort of person at the heart of it?
And that scene in the staircase then leads to another really telling scene for Rebecca where, you know, she meets again with the director played by Julie White. And she's just very blithe about, oh, we're going to lose the space. Oh, well, you know, like she's remaking herself over and over and over again and not necessarily conscious of who is kind of collateral damage in that. Which I think is very telling. In episode 4, Rebecca meets Alicia, played by America Ferrara, in a scene that I have to ask, Drew, it reminded me of a certain viral tweet about someone showing up to a party in a costume. And I'm wondering, I'm referring to the Babadook tweet, Katie Dipple, you know, because Rebecca shows up full Navi, in the blue, and no one else is that dressed up. I'm curious, where did that scene did personal life inform art in this case?
Maybe subconsciously. Okay. In actuality, Rebecca did in fact go as a Navi to a party, which we had a photograph of, and it was just one of those things we came across where we just said, okay, we have to work this in the show somewhere. So if art's imitating life, it's just kind of it's serendipity. But Richard, I actually do want to return to one thing that you just said, which I thought was very, very insightful, which is Rebecca kind of throwing herself from identity kind of into these different identities. And that was something that when Annie first came aboard, that was like one of her kind of key insights is just this person kind of so desperately searching for their place in life and so desperately searching for their thing that she kind of takes on and discards, you know, these various identities, but does so with like such reckless abandon that like you can't help but worry for her, right? Like, you know, it's not going to lead to a good place. So I just thought I think that was a kind of a keen insight that really informed her character for us.
And sorry, just to add one thing on that too, you know, Adam and Rebecca are both incredibly self-involved and they leave a wake of destruction in their path. And that's just the beginning of it. So you see in this thing that she just kind of, as you said, she kind of blithely just says, oh, yeah, we'll figure, you know, oh, maybe. And then she walks out of the room. There's a real consequence of that. They had a space in this area where all of a sudden Julie White's character and all these actors had, you know, had booked shows and everything like that. And then this woman just kind of throws it away. And you know, what happens to those actors and to Julie White's character, you know, in the aftermath of that? And you see that that's just the beginning of it. And as the show goes on, you see all of these moments where Adam and Rebecca's actions and often selfish behavior, there's real consequences to other people. And somehow they manage to kind of remain above the fray. But all these other people are dealing with their the fallout.
Yeah. And I think in episode 5 specifically, we see another fallout of that kind of reckless reinvention with the Alicia character. And, you know, because I guess these times with YouTube stars and social media stars, like, personhood is a brand. And Rebecca, she meets with a brand consultant and she's trying to figure that equation out. And then Alicia kind of becomes the victim of that. I'm curious about the particular psychology of this arc between these two, you know, new friends. Did Rebecca kind of seek to destroy this person deliberately out of envy, or was this just another kind of like, oops, I wasn't, you know, collateral damage kind of situation?
Gosh, you know, it's so interesting. I do not think that she set out to destroy anyone. I think that in the kind of, you know, in this kind of hole that couldn't be filled, like, seeing, like, when once these titles became something that, like, that were kind of valuable or desirable to her, I think it just, I'm going to take them kind of regardless of the collateral damage. So I think it was, I think it was like, sometimes she herself didn't even realize what she was doing, which is part of the danger of someone like that.
And just to add to it, I mean, I think that if you look at Rebecca's character, this is someone who wanted to be an actress and is living in the shadow of Gwyneth Paltrow, who, you know, for so much of her formative years is, you know, Rebecca's watching as she wins an Oscar, as she dates the biggest movie stars in the world. She's at Cannes. She, you know, she's living the life that she wants. And what does that feel like when your first cousin is living the life that you've always dreamed of? And then ultimately that doesn't work out for her. And I think that Rebecca is someone who kind of moved, you know, she studied yoga. She went to India and studied under the Dalai Lama. She was someone who was always searching and looking, and then kind of, you know, reinserts herself into WeWork in a bigger way. And as a result of that, I don't think that it was something, you know, conscious that she was doing, where she kind of set her sights on Alicia to take her out. But I think that she was trying to find her place and trying to assert her value. Also in episode 5, you know, you see that on the red carpet, Adam is the star. And Rebecca, again, is on the sidelines watching as someone else is getting all the credit and all the adulation. The same thing is in episode 2 at the end at that JP Morgan conference that you mentioned. She had just, you know, she just quit acting, and Miguel says, some people just have it, and he's a star. And you see Rebecca is watching as, you know, as Bruce Dunleavy and all these people are kind of lauding Adam. And I mean, I think Anne Hathaway's performance in those final moments of episode 2 is just riveting. I mean, it's silent, and her face, I think her face, you know, has 14 different emotions on it within, you know, the span of 2 seconds.
You know, what one thing I do want to circle back to, Richard, is just because I don't think some of Rebecca's behavior was conscious or consciously malicious, it doesn't mean it's not terribly dangerous, right? Like,
yeah,
in the real world accounts of how she would fire people for bad energy, right? Like, I think she seemed to us to possess this power of self-delusion such that she became convinced of her worldview, and it kind of allowed her to do anything, even as something as capricious as to kind of toss people aside, to end their careers and their livelihoods over something as laughable, as ridiculous as having bad energy. So I think, you know, it can be subconscious or sublimated or not malicious, quote unquote, but still terribly dangerous.
Yeah. And, you know, from documentaries that have come out, or, you know, all the other material about WeWork, it's clear that there was something really dark happening at the center of this. And I think what's so potent about that is that it came from something kind of idealistic in some sense. You know, I want you all to know what it was like to grow up in a kibbutz and, you know, sort of in this collectivist utopia. And I don't know, I guess my question about Adam and how you two decided to characterize him is, do you think there is a version of him and WeWork or something similar to it that would have worked, you know, in like the slightest different alternate dimension, you know, or was this inevitably doomed no matter how you approach it? Adam's a ticking time bomb. He's always going to kind of destroy as he goes.
Well, I mean, I think that Adam is someone, nothing was ever enough for him. I mean, the idea of someone talking about wanting to be president of the world and not wanting to be a billionaire, wanting to be a trillionaire, there were never going to be enough. You know, they talked about, you know, he talked about having a WeWork on Mars. You know, there was never, the world wasn't big enough for him. Is there, I think that the idea of WeWork and, you know, having spent time inside of them was a great one. I think it makes a lot of sense, particularly for freelancers. The space was beautiful. It was comfortable. There was a community aspect to it. I think that the company grew way faster than it was capable of doing. And in a lot of ways, you know, getting the $4.4 billion from Masa was the worst thing that could have ever, you know, you think, oh, well, an infusion of so much money like this, now you're going to move on to, you know, even greater successes. But I think, in fact, the $4.4 billion and Masa saying you're not crazy enough, that's the worst thing that ever happened to Adam Neumann. That's the worst thing that ever happened to WeWork. WeWork is a great idea that, had it grown organically, probably could have been, you know, worth several hundred million dollars, maybe, you know, a few billion dollars, and that would have been great. But as a result of growing at the rate that they did, you know, they're opening locations that, you know, the front doors don't work. They have inoperable toilets. Like, there's just no way to kind of to pull off what they wanted at the speed that they attempted to do it, at the scale that they did, and have it be successful. So I think that ultimately, that was the problem. Like, when you look at these VCs, you know, the win is not that you take a company that's valued at $1 billion and turn it into a company that's valued at $3 billion and you 3x it. You know, the success is when you have a $1 billion company and you turn it into a $130 billion company. And, you know, we reference Alibaba and Masa's success with that. And I can't remember what his, you know, how much he made off of it, but it's like a 32,000x. You know what I mean? So if that's
it's like 7,500x.
7,500x. So if that's the goal that you're going for, no one's ever going to achieve that. That's a once in a century success. And if you tried to do that for every company, that's how you have companies implode the way that WeWork did.
Yeah, I mean, that's a Gilded Age stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, Richard, totally. I mean, that's it. Yeah, not only is it Gilded Age stuff, it's like, I think for people who think, for those who think that we weren't quite hard enough on Adam and Rebecca, right? I guess a counter would be, I think it sort of lets too many people off the hook if you just choose to vilify these two individuals, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the more kind of blame you heap just on their shoulders, the more blame you sort of, you know, you let others kind of escape. So, for example, Adam takes Masa on a tour for 12 minutes, right? And Masa invests $4 billion, right? And you said, oh, was Adam destined to fail? Like, it's not just that Adam convinced someone to give him $4 billion in 12 minutes. What does it say that someone gave essentially a stranger $4 billion after 12 minutes, right? And sure, they had done their due diligence and they looked at their, you know, I'm sure they looked at their financials, but like, there is this kind of cowboy recklessness to some of that investment that it's not just Adam or Rebecca or the people taking the money. It's who's giving them the money.
There's something addictive about it, you know, and I think that in Leto's performance and in your writing, Adam is, and Rebecca to an extent, you know, is this kind of magnetic figure who you might be skeptical of, but you kind of want to believe that he's onto something. And even just that little kernel of hope can lead you to write that check, I guess, you know. And you're right that, like, they couldn't have done this alone. So I guess my next question for you guys would be, like, this word has been thrown around a lot. I don't know where I fall on it, but, like, was this a cult?
I mean, a little bit. Yeah. I think that the people that worked there, I think they really did. Adam was messianic and he was a cult leader, and he stood up on stage and people lauded him, and there were chants, and so many of the kind of the telltale signs of people being brainwashed did exist within the WeWork culture. It's late nights, it's lack of sleep, it's drinking, it's a messianic figure at the center, you know, it's an ethos about changing the world. All of those things you could apply directly to something like Nexium. And when I was funny, I watched the Nexium documentary, you know, while we were making the show, and you started seeing a lot of the similarities. It's, you know, the summer camp thing. You're taking people away from their families. They're gone for the weekend, and there's a little bit of an indoctrination. And the people that we spoke to, you know, a lot of times these are their first jobs out of college. There's no context. You know, if you're 45 and you'd worked at five different places, and they're, you know, now people are insisting you have to work, you know, drink till 3 a.m. and, you know, we're encouraging people to stay late at work and all that stuff, you'd say, no, I don't need to do that. I'm comfortable. You know, I have a family. But these people, you know, the people who were working at these companies, a lot of them ended up living at WeLives. And, you know, so you kind of, the world becomes insular, and your friends are your coworkers. And there's something that sounds very appealing about that. But as you get older, it's like, no, I need to decompress from this. I need a life beyond it. And I think in a lot of ways, it was very similar to a cult.
Yeah, I mean, I can relate. I started my media career at Gawker in 2007.
Oh, yeah.
And I was there for on and off for 4 years. And I wasn't living at the office, thank God. But like, there, I spent all of my time with my coworkers socially. You know, it was even though a lot of us were working from home most of the time, like it is intoxicating. You know, when you feel like you're on the vanguard of something, and you know, so I certainly don't blame these young people who took this exciting job. But there is just kind of this general aura of like complicity might not be the exact right word, but something close to that, where it's like the Newmans just, like I said, didn't do this by themselves.
Yeah. And by the way, like in some ways, like it's what Adam did. It's kind of crazier than a cult, in the sense that in a cult, you're usually talking about, you know, sort of existential issues of like, you know, and sort of spirituality and salvation. He made people believe this stuff about co-working space. That's what Lee and I always came back to, that like all this talk about changing the world and elevating the world's consciousness, like he wasn't even selling salvation. He was selling co-working space with kombucha.
Yeah. Well, he says something in that, I think it's in the first episode when he goes to speak to the students at Baruch, you know, just to let you know, no one's going to tell you this, but like, you're going to spend the rest of your life chasing this feeling. And I think I'm old enough now that I don't pine for the college days, but like that kind of bummed me out for a while. And I can see, you know, recent graduates being like, let's do it again, you know, and indefinitely this time. There's no 4-year cap on this experience. I get it, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when we listened to Real Adam, and when we, you know, we took a lot of, you know, we pulled a lot of dialogue directly from his mouth, there really are compelling ideas underneath it. And that's something that makes it more complicated, you know, that, again, going back to whether or not he's a con man or a visionary, either way, you're falling under the spell of it. I have friends that are brilliant that have invested in, you know, had great success as investors. And they got tours of WeWork early on, and they were like, yep, that was amazing. It was really incredible. And he was really able to kind of cast a spell on people and really get people to believe in something, even when there wasn't a lot, you know, the money wasn't behind it.
Well, I think that we're able to talk about all this stuff in sort of these nuanced terms is testament to the great work that you two have done. The show is so emotionally interesting, and, you know, it's this reflective piece about, you know, like I said, like what we've just all lived through, the end of the millennial dream, all that. So I really thank you for the show, and I thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Good talking to you.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
All right, Chris. So, let's switch over to The Dropout now. Heroes. I think I know who the heroes of this episode are, but I'm curious, do you think it's referring to the reporters or the whistleblowers, or what do you think the title is in reference to?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. And I think everyone sort of thinks, like, Elizabeth Holmes, and so they think they're the heroes, even though they sort of deep down know they're the villains. But, and I do think it's referring to the whistleblowers and the reporters and whatnot. But I also, this is sort of a third option, or someone who I really think was actually sort of the hero, one of the heroes of the episode, was George Schultz's wife, the step-grandmother, saving Tyler Schultz in that heated debate, in the negotiations, and sort of giving him an out, and sort of being a sense, like, a force of reason, and saving her step-grandson from that terrible situation. And then you have Phyllis Gardner. There's so many different heroes, but at least that to me really stood out. And I was like, oh, that's when I was like, oh, that's the title of that episode for me.
Yeah, and these are all people, Charlotte Schultz, played by the great Ann Archer, who are, it's really refreshing 7 episodes in to see not just people who are directly involved with the company, but who are at least aware of its, what it's doing from a distance, be like, well, this all really sounds like bullshit. Like, the whole thing, the worm has turned, the writing is on the wall. Elizabeth might not know it yet, but, like, someone like Charlotte is like, no, we need to, like, get out of this.
Yes,
you know?
We need, the house is on fire. We have to get out. Like, she gets it. And, like, George Schultz, is either too old or too proud to see that, and is willing to sacrifice his own grandson to the Theranos, you know, gods, just to, you know, be right, which is crazy.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely too proud. You know, when Tyler says to him, like, so don't you see that she's lying? She lied to you about what I was going to be signing today, you know, and George had been willing to, like, have the lawyer, Linda, hiding in the house somewhere.
Yeah.
That he could then be like, surprise, here she is. And then she comes with a whole different list of demands and things to sign than George had been made aware of. And yet even that doesn't convince him, because, again, he can't at this juncture, this, not just monetary investment, but investment of his professional reputation, he can't admit that he was so grievously wrong.
Oh my goodness. I will say, I would love to have Michaela Watkins just hiding in my house. You know, that would be really wonderful. So that's not a bad thing. But no, I mean, I think it's so correct. And honestly, there's a parallel to sort of SoftBank and WeCrashed and Mao, you know, and that sort of, like, the benefactor who is given so much. I mean, in that case, it's, you know, $4.4 billion. In this case, it's, you know, George Schultz's stamp of approval, and now is in too deep and refuses to, can't just say, oopsies. Like, he's not going to say that, like, oopsies, I made a mistake. He will go down with the ship, even if that means sacrificing his grandson. And that was a pretty erring, I thought. I mean, there were 2 big negotiation scenes in this episode that were both wonderful. The Wall Street Journal scene with, you know, and with the Theranos lawyers, and then also the Tyler Schultz, George Schultz, Linda of it all. And I thought they were both really well done and really excellent.
Yeah, the scene with the Wall Street Journal with John Carreyrou and I believe a fictional editor called Judith Baker, where they leave that meeting and they're like, we just got it. Like, they just told us, like, confirmed that these machines aren't running these tests. That scene is so fascinating because I can't quite tell, and maybe you have thoughts on this, like, Does the Theranos side of things realize they just completely screwed themselves over in that moment?
Well, it's so funny because I thought about this too, because I didn't even feel like they got it when they were like, we got it. I was like, did you get it? Like, I'm still nervous. I don't feel like that was such, like, a slam dunk, you know, hit out of the park, so to speak. And given that, I also think that Theranos, well, I think with Theranos, there's so much to hide. There are so many things that were terrible about their, you know, their science and their business practices and whatnot, that, like, I don't think they realize in that moment, by giving them that little sliver of, you know, that one piece, that one domino, that the rest would fall in the way that they did. I think there was just, you know, when there's, you know, a million things that are wrong, you give them one, you think, okay, I got it. At least I have 999,000 that are still hidden.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's something that I think is really helpful about this episode. And now that we're bringing in these outside observers from the Wall Street Journal or other places who are, like, kind of you know, condensing all of the many wrong things that Theranos is doing into really legible form. Like throughout this season, even though it's really well plotted, it's easy to follow, but you do kind of get lost in what exactly was a lie and how much were they actually doing. And this episode really snapped me back into clarity of like, oh no, the whole thing is like nothing. They are not doing anything that they say they're doing.
Yeah. Every single thing is wrong or broken and terrible. And it made it crystal clear in a very, as you said, legible way. And I will say the editor best comedic moment of the season, her bam, 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 her stabbing fish metaphor with John Carrier was really, really fantastic. So we even got some laughs.
Yeah, no, that scene is great with the Sicilian fisherman. I would fully watch a whole series where Lisa Gay Hamilton is the steely editor of a newspaper because she's doing a lot with like a small kind of functionary role.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, the show is so well cast, you know, really from top to bottom. Any episode that has Lisa Gay Hamilton and Ann Archer and Laurie Metcalf. Like,
yeah, stalwart actresses. We love to see it. And they all do great work.
So, yeah, I mentioned Laurie Metcalf, who plays Phyllis Gardner. That is quite a striking scene right there at the very end of the episode where Phyllis finally gets to say her piece. And I think, you know, through her, the show is making a broader point about one of the many things that Elizabeth Holmes' scam did harm to, which is that, like, how now can any woman say that she's being on the up and up, that, like, how will anyone believe her because of you? And then I think Phyllis says it was never just about you, you know. And in that moment, I think, do you think that gets through to Elizabeth in any meaningful way?
Well, in a similar way to what we said about Anne and sort of like the emotional core and sort of having and having some moments of vulnerability where you do sort of feel like, oh, you feel, I don't want to say bad, but you have empathy for that character. I do think that that broke through to Elizabeth, or at least in Amanda Seyfried's wonderful performance, her taking in that information. I did feel a sense of like profound disappointment because, you know, seven episodes ago, you know, Elizabeth Holmes was, you know, looking up to Phyllis Gardner, you know, and asking Phyllis Gardner for help. And so I think there was a sort of a, you could feel that like well of respect, and at least from Elizabeth Holmes' side, being like, oh, wow, look at us. We're both here together. We're equals. We're the same. I've done it. You've done it. And sort of wanting that mutual admiration. And for Laurie Metcalf, brilliant lead to, as Phyllis Gardner, to just completely sever that tie and say, not only are we not girlies, or not only are we not in the same place, you have now ruined things for a whole swath of women. That, I do think, struck an emotional chord with Elizabeth Holmes, as played by Amanda Seyfried, and it did for me as well.
Yeah, I think in that scene, you also, I mean, throughout this episode, you realize, and I think that Elizabeth is realizing it to some extent, like, how really isolated she is, because so much of her life exists in a lie, and that really the only true person she has in some ways is Sunny. Mm. But that relationship is so complicated and fraught, and, you know, they're playing a weird game of hide and seek in their huge mansion that I don't think either of them seem to like, you know. It's just like, and then, you know, you have in the scene with George and Tyler and Linda and Charlotte, like, where he says, when George is surprised that these new documents have presented themselves and Tyler is supposed to sign them, and he's like, did Sonny put you up to this? So, like, even Elizabeth's closest allies don't like Sonny, but that's all she has. You know, it's sad, almost.
It's really sad. And I will say, I mean, Naveen Andrews, wonderful. He's doing such great work, and he's really fantastic in the role. And I will say, like, not, and this is a total separate thing, but I also, you know, have empathy for Sonny. Like, George Shultz, you know, his distaste for Sonny definitely seems to come from somewhat of an, you're an other, you're not in the boys club, you're, you know, a brown man. It seems to come, at least it reads to me, it's somewhat racial, and Sonny knows that, and that's been a sort of a through line. You know, we have that scene a couple episodes before when he gets stopped at the airport, so that is a through line. And I will say, as messed up as this is, I do believe their love story in a weird way. I think because of exactly what you said, they're the only people in the world that have each other, right? They're the only people that know exactly sort of all the levels of depravity that they've sort of sunk to get as high as they've, you know, soared. And so I do feel this sort of like real affection between Elizabeth Holmes and Sunny in the show that makes it all the more complicated and complex in terms of, you know, their relationship. I think it's really fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's just that kind of like, you know, foxhole bonding where they're like, we're the only people who really know how much we're lying, you know, and they don't even say, we don't see them say it to each other that much. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a couple episodes ago where Elizabeth's like, okay, we're going to run it on the Siemens machines, but this is just early phases. Like, it's okay. And that's the extent to which we've seen her and Sunny kind of collude together. But they are doing it, whether it's spoken or not. And yeah. In that's like, that's the truest bond that Elizabeth can have because Sonny's the only person who really knows what she's up to.
Yeah. And he's, yeah, I mean, I won't go back to Macbeth, but it's like his Lady Macbeth is actually running the show. It is actually making things happen and is yelling at people and is doing what sort of needs, you know, quote unquote needs to be done to make Theranos successful by hook or by crook, by any means necessary. I mean, and to see him run after, it was such a great moment at the beginning of the episode when Linda Michaela Watkins like speed walks into Elizabeth's office to be like, hey, like Mark has downloaded all these emails and now he's leaving the building. And she, Elizabeth Holmes, completely freezes. She does not do anything or say anything. She's stuck in that moment. And it's Sunny who jumps into action and is like, we've got to go get him. I'm going to run. I'm going to chase him and scream at him. And we're going to sue his ass to kingdom come. So I just think like that sort of like, as much as Elizabeth Holmes is the face of the company and is the boss and is the girl boss of the world, Sunny is the one who springs into action, who's like sort of makes decisions when the pressure is on.
Which is why toward the end of the episode, it's so chilling when she and Sunny are disagreeing and she says, I'm the CEO. I don't read all my emails. Basically saying like, I have like an out, like you're the one who's really hands-on with this, you know? Yeah. And you start to think like, was that part of her strategy somehow? You know, because we see in the real world when these things, you know, I think Sunny Balwani's trial is starting soon if it hasn't already. Obviously, Holmes has concluded with four guilty verdicts. They both kind of, you know, to use reality show parlance, threw each other under the bus. You know,
oh yeah, they I didn't know the anything.
It was all them. You know, and then here in this episode, we see Elizabeth kind of threatening him and laying that subtle groundwork of like, you know, that like if push came to shove, like I'm so busy, like how can I be expected to read all these emails? But like there's more record of you having read and engaged with this stuff than me. And I think that puts a big dent in this picture of a very, albeit tortured, but like still loving relationship.
Yeah. I mean, the veiled threats of it all are so palpable. You can feel that tension and you can feel that Sunny has, you know, Sunny then goes like one step above her and is like, look, like you think I love you so much that I would just take the fall for you for this? That's not how it is. Like that's not how it's going to go down, sweetie. Like it really is. It's wild. I do want to say, I would like to go back to sort of the beginning of the episode. Something that I think was so well done is sort of like the interstitials of Elizabeth Holmes talking to Biden and, you know, Charlie Rose. That was a jump scare. Definitely Bill Clinton. All of these sort of, you know, luminaries and also these sort of, we got to say it, old white men, about her like massive success as we're sort of seeing these things fall to pieces. And it did sort of remind me of a really great but sort of sad episode of television in Cheers season 2 with Jerry Harris, who, you know, been convicted of multiple crimes against children, how that episode began with him, his ascent, him talking to Oprah and Biden and a lot of the same people that Elizabeth Holmes was talking to in sort of a similar way of these scammers sort of excelling to the highest heights of our society, all while there's this insidious underbelly that sort of, you know, the floor is gone, you know? So I just thought that was a really, really well done sort of montage to sort of set us up for, you know, we're one episode out, the fall is happening.
Yeah, and it's just a reminder of how bogglingly far she got with this lie. Like, how many people she ensnared in this. And, like, you know, one specter looming over this episode is Rupert Murdoch, who, you know, was an investor in Theranos at some point, and who she asked to have the John Carreyrou story killed, you know. And, you know, she comes home having met him at some function, you know, leading up to this weird game of hide and seek in the mansion. And that's, like, she's so excited about it. It's like, oh, I'm, I, you know, I met Rupert Murdoch tonight. And it's like, that is her stand-in for friend or, or ally or something. It's like, I met this powerful old white guy, and therefore I must not be alone. I am doing something. The lie is not going to be found out, because how could it be if I keep having access to these people?
Totally, exactly. I will say, too, it's funny, both We Crashed and The Dropout, Time Galas made it, the Time Gala made it big. So maybe, you know, when those Time 100 lists come out, we should just, you know, give it a once over, you know? Before we publish.
So we are, you know, like you mentioned, this is the penultimate episode of The Dropout. Sadly, we only have one more left. What do you hope for the finale? Where do you hope it ends? Like, I mean, I don't think we're going to see the trial, but maybe we will. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about how you think this story should end, at least in the TV version of it?
Yeah, I mean, I, as much as I would love to see the trial, I don't think that's the story that this show is telling. Like, I don't think that's where we should end up going. And I don't want to see sort of like a truncated, like, you know, best of version of that. Like, I think that's, it's probably better to steer clear of that. But I do need to see, or I would like to see Elizabeth sort of come to terms, have a reckoning, have a big reckoning moment, which I think you can't get at a trial, because at the trial she's saying, you know, I didn't do it. I'd much rather see her, you know, have this moment of like, oh, I have done so much more harm than I have done good, even if my intentions were pure, even if I, you know, am a smart woman, or, you know, and, you know, had a good, if impossible, idea. I need that reckoning moment, and I do think we'll get it, and I think Amanda will deliver a wonderful performance. Yeah, I guess, does that make sense?
It does, yeah. No, I think that, like, if they were to show a little bit of the trial, it runs the risk of being like a House of Gucci ending, where it's like, oh, and by the way, she went to trial for murder and was convicted, and a movie over, you know, and you're like, okay, wait a second.
like Whiplash,
show a lot, show a lot more of that or none of it, because this doesn't really work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I would let, so I'm like, let's just not do that, you know, because I don't think we have the time or the space to do that. And also, I will say, as well with Elizabeth Holmes, I want every person involved in Theranos. I want Sonny to have this moment. I want George Schultz to have this moment, even though apparently, I don't know if he ever did have that moment. I want Linda. I want all of these people to sort of reckon with the fact that not only did they get got, you know, by like the media and the, you know, the Wall Street Journal and whatnot, but also that they did like serious harm to lots of people.
Yeah, in that way, I kind of hope it ends on like Erica Chung, or, you know, one of these whistleblowers kind of having a moment of like, you know, because she and Tyler Schultz are still like, I think, friends and still work together. They started an initiative about like ethics in tech, I think. So maybe that would be a sort of to maybe prove Phyllis a little bit wrong, that like women in this space can, you know, Elizabeth didn't ruin it for everybody. But I don't know, if maybe the show is not quite so optimistic. But so lastly, we should turn to Super Pumped, which is another very media heavy episode. This episode, The Charm Offensive, is really about Kalanick trying to convince not the public necessarily, but certainly the press, that he's not a monster. I mean, he literally says that at this very strange dinner in New York with Michael Wolff, the, you know, sort of famed media reporter, and then Ben Smith, who's the surprise BuzzFeed guy, who's no longer, he's at the Times now. You know, you work in media, same as me. Did this seem credible to you? That this kind of thing would have happened?
I mean, not to sort of show my cards, but I certainly have not been invited to like a fancy dinner in a basement with a tech CEO. But I guess that's not my beat. I guess, yeah, it sort of didn't strike me as credible. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm sure it did, or maybe it potentially did. But it felt really sort of random, and it seemed like so clearly a bad idea, and like, especially then once Ben Smith sits down there, it's like you like to go through with it, and then, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's like, you know, freak out after it once it becomes clear that, you know, information was divulged. It was like, really? I found myself saying really a lot during that whole sequence.
Yeah, and it's this elaborate thing, you know, organized by the PR team, and it's an interesting way that the episode is structured, because they're pointed toward that. They're pointed toward big media, the traditional stuff. And then we have Susan Fowler, who starts to write the blog that really a lot of people credit with taking down Kalanick in the end, because she wrote this really, you know, thorough thing about all of the sexual harassment that she had experienced, that her female coworkers had experienced. And that's not where anyone, you know, from the Uber side of things at that dinner is looking, you know. And it's just like, how can you at the cutting edge of tech not understand that someone can write a blog post and it can be as effective as, I don't know, charming Michael Wolff or even Ben Smith can be?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's so well put. And I found that Susan Fowler, played by Ava Victor, is a great comedian and actress. I found that element of the show, or those scenes, to be way more sort of interesting and sort of, interesting and just sort of better to me than the, you know, secret dinner party of it all. Because it did sort of show very sort of point by point, like how the culture sort of devolved very quickly over time. I mean, the culture was never really set up for women, but it showed sort of like all of the sort of vignettes. I thought that was pretty well executed and compelling. And as you said, like, that's the thing that's going to blow up the, you know, somebody, you know, inside the company saying like, hey, this company sucks for women. I feel like, how did they miss that? Why were they not paying attention to that?
And, you know, Travis is cognizant that women at the office are having issues, but he doesn't treat it, because, I mean, I think it speaks to his inherent disrespect for women in general. He doesn't treat it as something that could be of consequence, you know? He's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But, like, I think that's what's so satisfying about the Susan Fowler stuff in this episode, is that we have spent now, you know, so many hours with Travis and watching him be a complete asshole and bulldoze through people and kind of come out on top most times. Mm-hmm. And then we have, you know, this side story about this woman who is going to do serious harm to his reputation and his position at the company. And we have Travis doing this sort of hat in hand, please, sir, like me with Tim Cook from Apple,
yeah,
who's a gay man, you know, and really is not really he Travis's shtick does not work on Tim Cook at all. And that's really satisfying to watch after so many hours of seeing it work with other people.
Yeah, that was great. That was very like, you know, Velma Kelly in an act of desperation is what I thought during that sort of like that tete-a-tete between, Travis and Tim Cook. And I found, that was quite satisfying when he was like, guess what? Steve Jobs, you asked me if I knew Steve Jobs. Yeah, I didn't know Steve Jobs and he wouldn't like you at all. Like, that was really wonderful. And I do think sort of my problem with Super Pumped, and I don't know if I'm the first to say this or whatnot. We got all these scammer shows coming out and whatnot. And with each scammer show, I do think, you know, not all scammers are created equal and not all scammers are as charismatic or as interesting characters as, you know, as the other. And I do think, like, with, you know, Jared Leto's Adam Newman, say what you want, like, that is an interesting character. That is a charismatic, sort of interesting person, and you're seeing that on screen in We Crash. Elizabeth Holmes, like, she is an interesting character of a woman, you know, a study of a woman, right? With Super Pumped, even Inventing Anna, like, she's a sort of, you know, more of a sociopath to me, but, like, she was interesting, at least to me. With him, with Super Pumped, I just feel like I'm watching just, like, some like asshole in a sweater be an asshole in a sweater. And I don't find, I don't know. I don't find it to be nearly as compelling, because I find there to be like no there with this guy. And seeing Tim Cook say that was great.
Yeah. And, you know, to be generous to the show, I guess, like, maybe that's part of the deliberate structure of it, which is like, we're going to give you a lot of this guy working. And then, you know, episode 5 or whatever, he's going to find the limit of that. And it's not just a limit in terms of like a peer. This is someone who really wields a lot of power over him. And it's very satisfying to watch. And I think that the way that the scene with Tim, or the scenes kind of sewn throughout the episode with Tim Cook are written and performed, like, you know, Hank Azaria is playing Tim Cook as, you know, very quiet, sort of, you know, folksy. He's from the South. He's from Alabama. And he's not being mean to Travis. You know, his lieutenant is being like, when Travis starts to say the gay thing, his lieutenant's like, stop right there, you know?
Yeah.
So there is some air of antagonism in the room, but it's not coming from Tim Cook until the very end when he says the thing, you know, the sort of you're no Jack Kennedy kind of thing about Steve Jobs, and says, oh, by the way, the China thing isn't happening. So goodbye. You know, like it's a much more deft and skillful way to be a sort of, you know, corporate warrior than Travis does, which is just to like bellow and, you know, thrash and all that stuff. And Tim Cook is like, no, you can be kind of the quiet assassin, which I just did.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'd think that Travis would maybe get out of his own way and learn something from that interaction to what just happened to him. And like, that clearly doesn't happen when you see him, you know, throughout the episode, you know, screaming at his PR people for like mistakes that like were sort of ultimately his fault for, you know, the dinner going awry, you know? So it's just, it was quite, it's so funny. I'm so glad that you said that was Hank Azaria, because I kept being like, who is that? And I didn't look it up. But wow, Hank Azaria, he was wonderful. But yeah, I do agree that Travis's, you know, assholish nature, that written into the, that being written into sort of the soup of the show. It's important.
I mean, it's to the point where it's going to be so juicy to just watch him realize that he's screwed, you know, like, and I think he's still on the Uber board. Like he wasn't like sent out into the wilderness, but he is going to lose control of the company, which, I think we're all eagerly anticipating. Yeah. Well, I think that just about wraps it up. I want to jump back to We Crash really quick before we leave, Chris, and ask you a vital question about our times. When was the last time you thought about the Harlem Shake meme? Because we do see that briefly in We Crash with the monkey mask and everything.
Oh my goodness! Well, Richard, you're gonna sort of reveal something about my age. I was in college when the Harlem Shake meme sort of was a big thing, and I hated it so much that I wrote an essay in our literary magazine about how it was stupid and appropriative and bad and erasing the actual Harlem Shake dance that originated in Harlem and is a real dance in Black culture. So I have a lot of feelings about the Harlem Shake.
Well, I was going to ask you what you want to plug, but I think you just did. I think people need to go find this essay.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the Nassau Weekly. Please look it up.
where can people find you other than the Nassau Weekly, Twitter or whatnot?
Yeah, okay, you could definitely, if not there, you can find me on Twitter and on Instagram. It's the same handle, @ChrisStress, like distress or mistress, you know. And at vanityfair.com, of course.
Great. Well, you can find me at vf.com as well, and I'm on Twitter as Rylaws. As ever, this episode was edited and produced by Dave Gonzalez. And until next week, happy investing.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.